This is Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusa, in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. A tax or not a tax? That was the question this week, as the Mitt Romney campaign had it first one way and then the other.
They concluded it was a tax. That's what it is. And the American people know that President Obama has broken the pledge he made.
Also this week, Massachusetts Congressman John Tierney broke his silence on the illegal gambling ring operated by his brothers-in-law.
Look, I regret having brothers-in-laws. I mean, frankly, you know, what did Henny Youngman say? Take my wife? Yeah, I'd say take my brothers-in-laws, please. But you don't get to choose those things in life.
Meanwhile, Beacon Hill lawmakers passed a major higher education overhaul that will tie budgets to student achievement at the state's two-year community colleges.
And this week, it got a little more expensive to ride the MBTA.
Relatively speaking, it's still a bargain. With that said, we know it is going to be difficult for some customers.
So those are some of this week's stories we're going to be diving into in our Week in Review. And first, for more on Mitt Romney's position on health care reform, and specifically on that mandate, we're joined by WBUR health care reporter Martha Biebinger. Hi, Martha.
Hi, Anthony.
So with regard to this big question about the mandate, you've been looking back at Mitt Romney's time as governor in Massachusetts. What did you find?
Yeah, Anthony, we thought it would be important to take a look back at how the governor got himself into this predicament of supporting the individual mandate. Did he see it that way at the time? So it looks like his path started with both a conviction and the numbers. The numbers were that there were about 500,000 uninsured residents of Massachusetts, and many of them were able to get free care through hospitals and clinics.
Mm-hmm.
And Romney decided that he could probably spend that money more efficiently. That's the conviction side. MIT economist John Gruber came in with some analysis that showed what would happen if you had a mandate or didn't have a mandate, and he offered some advice to both the governor and a group of advisors. Gruber remembers that the advisors were worried about tackling both the mandate and healthcare as a whole. They thought it was a politically risky move.
His political advisors did not seem very excited. His political advisors seemed to think this was not a great move for him, that this was too radical a step.
Radical in the sense, Anthony, that while moderate Republicans had taken it up before, more conservative Republicans and Democrats had not embraced this. You might remember back to 1993, U.S. Senators Bob Dole and John Chafee filed a bill that included the mandate. Now, it was roundly rejected by mostly conservative Republicans and Democrats.
So what eventually convinces Mitt Romney to embrace the mandate then?
Well, it was the analysis from Gruber and some outside consultants that really helped. But then there was some pressure that came in from, of all places, the Bush administration.
Hmm.
The administration said that it would no longer support major Medicaid payments to hospitals, where the people were getting a lot of this free care for the uninsured. The Bush administration wanted that money to go into the private sector, into insurance plans. And they threatened to withhold the money that was going to these hospitals. It was $385 million, or double it if you look at some people's calculations. And if the Romney administration didn't switch that money, they were going to lose it. So Romney's first public health commissioner, Christy Ferguson, says Romney just couldn't let the state give up that money.
It's very ironic. I think that a lot of what happened in Massachusetts was driven by the Bush administration.
That's ironic. Also ironic that the Democrats were opposed initially to the individual mandate.
Right. We've seen so many changes in the political landscape. If you go back to the 1980s, the individual mandate was in the Republican camp as a strategy for covering the uninsured. And the Democrats preferred the employer mandate, where employers would be required to provide coverage to their employees. So when leaders in Massachusetts were trying to forge a consensus about how to cover the uninsured, they figured the challenge would largely be to persuade Democrats in the establishment that an individual mandate was something they could support. Now, Alan Weil was one of the authors of a very critical report in this regard. It recommended both the employer and the individual mandate. And Weil knew that the individual mandate in particular would be a tough sell in Massachusetts.
No one likes the sound of the mandate. The mandate is intended to be a backstop, but there's really no way to get to universal without the mandate.
So, Martha, up until this point, right, these conversations are basically taking place behind closed doors. How does Romney pitch the mandate when he presented it to the public finally?
Well, I might start by saying, Anthony, that there were a lot of conversations about how to do this. What was the right language to use? So they didn't want to use the language of mandate. They wanted to talk about free riders who were taking advantage of this
responsibility
system.
Responsibility,
yes, right. Yes, exactly. And so Romney said on the day that he first proposed the individual mandate, he framed it as an issue, as you just said, of personal responsibility, and he called it the ultimate conservative idea.
I think it's a growing recognition, particularly among conservative think tanks, that the idea of having large numbers of individuals who can afford health care but choose instead to make the taxpayers pay, that doesn't work, that people have to have personal responsibility.
So the individual mandate, Anthony, comes out of this bipartisan spirit in Massachusetts with Democrats agreeing to support it, Republicans agreeing that this is the right way to go. And it just never faced really significant opposition here in Massachusetts. Nationally, there was some pushback, but not too much. And it became now, as you know, the cornerstone of President Obama's law, with Democrats championing the individual mandate. But that really left Governor Romney in the lurch as Republicans fled the idea. And I'll just mention one more irony, which is that on that day, back in 2005, when the governor first proposed the individual mandate, it was also the day when he first acknowledged that speculation about whether he would run for president, whether he was testing those waters, was true. So that the convergence of those two things have now been a liability that he's having a really hard time shaking.
Really interesting. Martha Biebinger covers healthcare and lately the politics of healthcare for WBUR. Thanks so much, Martha.
Thank you, Anthony.
Well, joining us now for more on this story, as well as the rest of the week's news, is John Carroll, mass communications professor at Boston University, author of the Campaign Outsider blog. Good as always, John.
Nice to be here, Adam.
Also with us after too long an interregnum is Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Dante.
Thanks. Nice to be here. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday to you. So let's just review how the healthcare political conversation developed this week. On Monday, Mitt Romney aide and Karl Rove of Massachusetts, Eric Fernstrom, talked to MSNBC's Chuck Todd about Romney's position on last week's Supreme Court ruling, specifically how Chief Justice John Roberts chose or opted to consider that fee that people who go without health insurance will have to pay, that Roberts chose to consider that a tax. Fernstrom said that Romney, who of course instituted basically the same thing in Massachusetts, doesn't see it as a tax, but as a penalty or a fine. Then on Wednesday, Mitt Romney said the total opposite on CBS.
Well, I said that I agreed with the dissent, and the dissent made it very clear that they felt it was unconstitutional. But the dissent lost. It's in the minority. And so now the Supreme Court has spoken, and while I agreed with the dissent, that's taken over by the fact that the majority of the court said it's a tax, and therefore it is a tax. They have spoken. There's no way around that. You can try and say you wish they had decided a different way, but they didn't. They concluded it was a tax. That's what it is, and the American people know that President Obama has broken the pledge he made. He said he wouldn't raise taxes on middle-income Americans. Not only did he raise the $500 billion that was already in the bill, it's now clear that his mandate, as described by the Supreme Court, is a tax.
So, Dante Ramos, let me ask you, did Fernstrom just not get the memo, or was there some kind of internal pivot decided upon within the Romney campaign this week? What do you think is going on here?
Well, if you just listen to Romney's comments just now, you know, there's a lot of verbiage around it, and it's hard to extract from that exactly what it is that he's saying. That may be on purpose. You know, he doesn't have a whole lot of room to maneuver on this issue, which only gained importance last week with this curveball decision from John Roberts that almost nobody expected. You know, it was a little surprising when Eric Fernstrom gave Obama a pass on the tax issue. It was less surprising when he walked it back. But the bottom line is, you know, this is a semantic issue, whether it's a tax or a penalty or a tax penalty, that probably matters a lot more to Romney's base than it does to the general electorate. And their best strategy at this point may be to say as little as they can, or at least as little that's kind of comprehensible as they can, and then try to change the subject.
Right, try to obfuscate the point. Romney is, of course, John, walking a very fine line here, saying that the Affordable Care Act uses a tax, but that his own Massachusetts reform is a penalty. First off, to Dante's point, does it matter? It's money that you got to pay if you don't have health insurance. Who cares whether you call it a tax or you call it an elephant?
Well, there's two things that are hurting Romney here. One is that he folded like origami as soon as the Rush Limbaughs and Bill Kristols came out and criticized him. When the Republican establishment came out and said, "Wait a minute, you know, this is one of our best piece of this is part of our best ammunition against Barack Obama in the fall," all of a sudden Romney switched positions. The other is he's going through this kind of Talmudic deconstruction of why the state mandate is different from the national mandate, and it just isn't going to sell. It just doesn't work. He hasn't figured out a way, and this was true in the debates all through the primary as well. He hasn't figured out a way to sell this and to sort of unburden himself from his own healthcare reform here in Massachusetts.
So if we're talking about largely meaningless semantic distinctions, Dante, is there anything informative that voters take from this entire episode?
Not very much. I mean, I think
well, I'm glad we're talking about it.
the some of the atmospherics around it probably are important. As John said, the rapidity with which the Republican talking heads kind of forced Romney into a different position is sort of, you know, interesting as you look at his campaign. The fact that a lot of people are now blaming the Boston people in his campaign rather than the candidate himself. Mm-hmm. You know, it speaks a little bit to the political process. You know, I think you'll probably see Romney kind of stumble through this question a little bit more, but I don't know that voters really take a whole lot away from it in the end.
Well, I think the only thing they're going to take away from it is that this plays into Romney's image as a flip-flopper. This plays into Romney's image as someone who is not sort of constant.
Stop talking about image, John. Is this evidence that he actually is a flip-flopper or not is the relevant question, right?
Well, that's true, too. Right. And I think, obviously, he is here. So this is one more instance where he's changed his positions. And this also plays out something that Rick Santorum said during the primary, which was Mitt Romney's the worst guy the GOP can put up if we're going to be campaigning against Obama on Obamacare, because he can't do it. He can't sell that. And I think we're seeing that now.
Well, sticking with the presidential race for just another moment and on to vacations in New England. Bear with me here. Mitt Romney was vacationing with his family in New Hampshire, enjoying the sun. Pictures of him with his wife Anne on a jet ski in Winnipesaukee were making the rounds, and they were clearly pictures that were not by like paparazzo. You know, it was like, you know, somebody they invited photographers in to take a picture of Romney on a jet ski. They wanted that picture out there. Meanwhile, President Obama, it's revealed that he's not going to do his usual vacation on Martha's Vineyard. John, what do you see in these two events? Obama, some have said, didn't want to be photographed in Tony Martha's Vineyard on the eve of the big election.
Right. I think it's an easy position for him to take. And today he was going around Ohio talking about how when he took vacations when he was a kid, he stayed at the Hojo's. And that was really upscale for him because it had a pool and everything. Forcing Romney to come out and get four square behind vacations. He issued a statement about vacations, that everybody should have a vacation. As far as the jet ski photo goes, I think, as Joan Vinaki pointed out in the Globe, you know, this could be his John Kerry moment in terms of Kerry out there in the windsurfing. The worst part of it, from my standpoint, is that Ann Romney is driving. And I don't think that works well for a guy who's running for president.
See, I took the
go ahead, Dante. Go ahead.
I took the windsurf the jet ski photo almost the opposite way from John and from my colleague Joan. You know, jet skis have a little bit more of a regular guy image than windsurfing.
They run on gasoline.
They run on gasoline. They use fossil fuels, and you see Romney sitting there straight upright. With his wife driving, and he looks more like a Bain Capital executive in a bathing suit than he does, you know, like a guy out for a fun day on the lake.
His legs were very lean and pasty, I noticed. But let's go ahead and move on.
Don't want to comment on
okay.
that.
Local politics. Massachusetts Congressman John Tierney represents the North Shore. This week held a news conference to address his family's legal problems. His brother-in-law, Daniel Aramian, was sentenced last week to 3 years in prison for his role in an illegal offshore gambling operation. Tierney has long maintained that he knew nothing about his brother-in-law's crimes. But after the sentencing, Aramian said that Tierney was lying, that he knew everything that was going on. Here's Tierney responding this week, finally, to those claims.
I think they're angry and bitter, Danny certainly, at the sentence he got, but I also think they're angry that their brother-in-law congressman didn't make this matter go away for them.
So Tierney's solution here was to have this marathon till they drop press conference in Salem this week to try to get it all behind him. Dante, do you think he succeeded?
Not really. You know, he's flatly denied knowing what was going on with his brothers-in-law. But, you know, there's some kind of the basic parameters of this case are, you know, it's hard for sort of, you know, your average person to totally swallow what he's suggesting. You know, most people would have difficult or would probably notice an extra $223,000 or however much the amount of money that his wife supposedly received if that came into their household. And, you know, similarly, the brothers-in-law here are not the most credible characters. At the same time, they've been under a legal cloud for quite a long time, and it doesn't sound as though Tierney had completely walled himself off from them in the way that, you know, a sitting congressman might be wise to.
John, I think the more pressing question here is, what does this mean for the outcome of the election? You know, it's hard to imagine a Republican winning that seat. On the other hand, Peter Torkelson, before Tierney, was a Republican. Mm-hmm. Now we got Richard Tesei, a former Republican state senator, running against Tierney. Could you actually see Tesei winning this thing in the end?
Yeah, this is one of the bigger problems for Tierney, is that a lot of the GOP congressional candidates that we've seen over the years have lacked credibility. But that's not true of Richard Tesei. And I think he's not only credible, but he's likable. And I think he's got a lot of things going for him, including a really good image with the press. So I think this is going to be one of the problems for Tierney, is that you know, he's up against a candidate who can take advantage of this situation. The other thing he's going to have to worry about is super PAC money. They don't have a People's Pledge the way Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown do. So super PAC money, I think, is going to come in. And one of the things that had been working in Tierney's favor, perhaps, was the timing of this issue, that it comes during the summer, it comes during a holiday week. You know, maybe it blows over by the time the campaign comes around. But the super PACs are going to make sure that that doesn't happen, that it doesn't go away. They're going to bring this back in the fall.
And national money, you think, is going to come in?
Absolutely. This would be a big win for the GOP to get a seat in the Massachusetts congressional delegation.
Okay, moving on. Governor Deval Patrick is expected to sign into law reforms to the state's 2-year community colleges, reforms that would tie a school's budget to student achievement. This sounds to me akin to No Child Left Behind for higher ed. Dante Ramos, is that essentially what we're talking about here?
It sounds like it. It's certainly 20 years of ed reform in Massachusetts along those lines, and No Child Left Behind kind of set the stage for this type of scenario. You know, my own view is that it makes a lot of sense to try to measure the effectiveness of community colleges, because, you know, we expect them to do a lot of things. We expect them to, you know, train people for or get people who want 4-year degrees to send them off on that path. But increasingly, we also rely on them to do workforce development. And right now, there's a lack of information about how well these schools are doing, even for their own goals. You know, you see that the schools as a group, the schools and their faculties, are kind of reluctant to assume this role of workforce development. But it's clearly something that's going to happen. And, you know, the counter argument that they make, that just give us more funding and it'll all be okay, you know, it sounds very unreconstructed, and it sounds kind of out of touch with the whole grain of ed reform in Massachusetts. So that's, you know, one argument for reform, I think.
Yeah. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say, in the late 70s, I was an adjunct at Massasoit Community College and was teaching English grammar through the lecture method. So it didn't work out that well. Their teachers are much better now than I was back then. At any rate, I think that the risk is becoming trade schools, but I think that performance evaluations and I think job training and placement are important. So I wouldn't say that would be the only yardstick to measure these the community colleges by, but I think it's a good thing for them to be able to do that for a number of students. Some students, you want to go to community college to move on to a 4-year college and finish a 4-year degree. But I think they can do both without suffering and without the students suffering as well.
Well, it's a really amazing and fascinating development in higher ed that kind of just sort of slipped into the discourse kind of suddenly, at least to my ear. So we're going to talk about it more on Radio Boston next week. Let's go to our last topic here. On Sunday, fare hikes at the MBTA went into effect. Julie Galber of Salem rides the commuter rail, and here's what she had to say.
My T-Pass went up about $50, so I guess that's $600 a year, so it's definitely a lot. I mean, I'm not really sure what else can be done, but I'm not happy about it.
Well, Julie Galber wasn't the only unhappy one. On Monday, the first workday after the new fare hikes, thousands of commuters weren't able to use their T-passes due to a software glitch, kind of adding insult to injury here, eh, Dante?
It does indeed. You know, this is a terrible, terrible, terrible situation. And it's part of a cascade of bad news for the MBTA. You know, on a hot summer day, the first day where these, or the first work day where these fares were in effect, you had angry commuters. You also had protests of the hikes on paratransit fares from disabled users. And, you know, there was a parallel scene of people trying to cash in these old T tokens that, you know, that the T probably should have stopped taking eons ago. It's, you know, it's kind of creates this image of disorder and dysfunction, which is not healthy for the T. I mean, the T labors under a lot of debt that basically, or isn't entirely their fault, and they need a long-term solution to their financial needs. But, you know, when people see these sort of things all happening at once, it kind of hurts their credibility and probably hurts the case for a long-term solution rather than helping it.
Very briefly, John, you know, is this, do you see a critical mass developing in terms of discontent with the MBTA, or is this just a case of 'twas ever thus?
I've always thought of the MBTA as being like someone's hobby, so my expectations are exceedingly low for them. And I think that the combination of higher fares and less service is going to be one that's going to be problematic for the MBTA. I think that you may see more and more people driving, which is going to cause its own set of problems. And I think that this is unfortunate that the two things are coming together, cuts in service along with higher fares. I mean, I think it's a recipe for real problems for the MBTA.
All right, gentlemen, let's move on to our concluding hubbub, the little story that didn't make it into the body of our conversation. Anthony.
So here's my hubbub. It comes courtesy of the Milford Daily News, and it talks about the value of a penny, or the value specifically of a penny or two saved. 35 years ago, Thomas Daigle bought a home, and he started collecting pennies the day he bought that home because he had this crazy idea to make his final mortgage payment with pennies. And he collected 62,000 pennies and brought them to the Milford Federal Savings and Loan Bank last April and made his final payment. Now, that's 800 pounds of pennies, in case you're wondering. And there's some great details in this story. I'm just going to read one of them. he was keeping these pennies in cardboard boxes, but they began to break because of the weight. So he bought a pair of rocket launcher ammo boxes to hold his pennies. And those are what he brought into the bank. So 62,000 pennies, and if you're keeping track at home, that's $620. And he paid off his home. So, I love that story.
Banks love it when you bring in rocket launchers.
What's not to like?
It really helps. Mine is the Romney Olympics, which were brought up in the Washington Post this week. The Romney family traditionally has had an Olympics, a mini triathlon of biking, swimming, and running. But a few years ago, when Mitt came in next to last, only able to beat out a daughter-in-law who had given birth to her second child a couple of months earlier, they changed it. And they expanded it to include hanging onto a pole the longest, throwing a football the farthest, and hammering the most nails into a board in 2 minutes. Those are now the events for their Olympics. So I think they've been downgraded significantly, and I don't think Mitt would be invited to Utah, to Salt Lake City, to save the Olympics under these conditions since this happened.
You're not wrong. Dante Ramos, your hubbub.
Okay. Well, my colleague Steve Sire noted in this morning's Globe that the Boston Beer Company's stock has risen to frothy new levels. Yesterday afternoon, it closed at almost $100 a share more than Facebook, and I think it has a higher price-to-earnings ratio than Google. Now, to hold up that stock price, you know, I hope the investors are drinking Sam Adams with their Frosted Flakes in the morning and with lunch and not just having a pop after work, because nothing else is going to hold up that stock price. On the other hand, if we're going to have another stock market bubble, why not craft beers?
Why not indeed? My hub is as follows. This week, when physicists revealed that they had finally observed the previously theoretical Higgs boson particle, or at least something very close to it, Twitter user Audi Cloud asked, anyone else keep reading Higgs boson as Higgs Boston? The answer, of course, is yes. Minneapolis-based public radio personality John Moe tweeted the following quote that he attributed to the Higgs-Boston particle. I'm wicked hard to find. Here's a joke that is predicated on the idea that the Higgs particle proves the existence of a universal field that endows all particles with mass. Derek J. Johnson tweets, without Higgs boson, Boston would be in Achusetts. Hey. And Republican State Representative Jeff Deal of Whitman, Mass. Wins the Radio Boston Twitter Joke of the Week award by eschewing the whole Boston boson pun altogether and instead going with a topical gag. He tweets, Higgs boson discovery? It's actually a tax. John Carroll, Mass Communications Professor at Boston University, author of the Campaign Outsider blog. Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor at the Boston Globe. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Up next, the Boston Police Union, the Boston Policemen Patrolmen's Association, and the ever-expanding controversy about their controversial newsletter. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.